Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Jeff Sullivan's on Twitter at @based_ball, and the Fangraphs senior editor joins us now on Sports Radio 670. Hello, Jeff. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Better than the Marlins. How are you?
That's kind of a low standard.
It's a good stick to set. Jeff, we've got a couple of changes in playoff odds, despite the fact that when I think the first time we had you on, everybody was set. We had the six division winners. We were all good to go, and really there was just one question. Is it the Dodgers that you're most worried about so early on, 15 games in? The Indians have looked a little irpy. The Cubs themselves have kind of been back and forth some. Is there one whose odds have changed the most that you've got your eyes on?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You came into the season, and I think we all kind of expected the same six division winners, at least five, right? There were five divisions that seemed like they were foregone conclusions. None of the six favorites are winning their divisions right now, not a single one. They're all behind by some decent gap, and the Dodgers and Nationals, Cubs are behind by significant gaps. I think I'm becoming most worried about the Dodgers. I still think they're the favorites in that division, but the Diamondbacks are very strong. They've weathered the storm being without Steven Souza. You know, the Dodgers have a thinner pitching staff than I think they've had in quite a while. It seems like Kenley Jansen has gotten himself straightened out, hasn't struggled since the season's first week, but Diamondbacks are coming off a very, very strong season. I know they just lost Taijuan Walker for some indefinite period of time, but they can just weather that storm. I mean, the Diamondbacks are already ahead of the Dodgers five games. Dodgers are in a division where the Rockies are pretty good. I think the Giants are better than they've looked. So I think that they're in some real trouble here.
Love the Freddie Freeman stuff on his trending to being more like Joey Votto in spitting on so many pitches and just waiting for his opportunities to find exactly the right pitch to hit. In general, when you see evidence of a player doing something different, a player who just looks different, I guess it's a question to you as sort of a one thing you do really well, I think, Jeff, is you notice things. You're a very good noticer of baseball, and then you can go to the numbers and go to video and say, am I seeing what I really think I'm seeing? How do you notice those things at this point in the season, and when is it significant enough to say, I think I'm seeing something that's worth investigating?
Yeah, the last one is critical, because you look at almost any single player is going to be cyclical over the course of the season. Take Mike Trout, and if he's going to have a 950 OPS, he's not going to have a 950 OPS in every single game. He's going to go up and he's going to go down, and this is just the way that players and teams are in every single category. But I think with a case like Freeman, something that's like a plate discipline and approach, how often you swing as a hitter is pretty particular to you. You've got guys who say that they like to be aggressive, guys who say they like to be more patient, and they don't change very much. Adam Jones is going to swing all the time, and Logan Forsythe might never swing all season long. So you just have these characteristics that usually don't change very much. So with a guy like Freddie Freeman, I still don't know. I mean, he's played, 14, 15 games this early in the season, and he's been such an aggressive hitter his entire career. The probability is still that this isn't going to be something permanent, but I don't think that a guy like that can fluke his way into swinging about half as often as he used to, maybe two-thirds as often as he used to. I think it's got to be something deliberate. I found out after writing that post that this offseason, Freddie Freeman actually had LASIK eye surgery, which historically doesn't make that big of a difference for baseball players. Their vision is already so good, but I don't know. It seems like an awfully big coincidence, right? That guy had eye surgery and all of a sudden he's spitting on more pitches than he ever did before. So that one kind of stands out to me.
Talking with Jeff Sullivan of Fangraphs on the Bernstein and McKnight Show here, 670 The Score. I know that, you know, Jeff, weather talk is usually the equivalent of the replacement player in conversations. It's just kind of the average. But is there anything solid to what we've seen with the postponements of baseball games, the 22 games we've seen already? Has there been any, to your knowledge, math on what extended layoff does to players? I mean, it feels like we have this conversation about teams that have that first round bye nowadays with a play-in game. Oh, they're 3 days off. Are the Indians going to be able to pitch the way they want to, or all that kind of stuff? Is there anything solid to what these teams have had to deal with?
I don't think we have anything that's real useful, because usually when you would look at something like this, you would look at an extended delay at the end of the season. And of course, at this point, we're at the very beginning of the season. Players aren't really fatigued yet, so I don't think players are benefiting from rest. So by the guess, I think that there would be a slight penalty to getting so many days off, especially when you think they're going to be days on. But on the other hand, it kind of feels like half of baseball is facing the same problem. So this is a consequence of starting the season earlier than usual. But you figure now, all of those extra off days that were built into the season, well, now they're being used up to play games that were postponed this past week or two. So this is really something, I'm going to say sensational. It's weather. It's not that sensational, but there wasn't a whole lot of baseball this weekend. That's just how it was. I don't think I've ever seen anything like this before. And I guess it works out because divisions are geographically aligned that you have a lot of teams that are kind of in the same boat. So I don't think that there's a real advantage necessarily for anyone here.
All right. Then what's the data on cold? Is there anything consistent that says either a certain kind of player, a player with a certain skill set, is hurt or helped by cold temperatures in Major League Baseball?
I think the most important thing that happens with cold weather is, according to renowned baseball physicist Alan Nathan, he's, whenever you have a baseball science question, you go to him, Professor Emeritus. But anyway, the math usually works out that when you have a change of about 10 degrees of temperature, then that's worth something like 2.5 or 3 feet of fly ball distance. So the long story short here being that when it's cold, there are a lot fewer home runs, which would be probably the most important explanation for why home runs have somewhat gone down this season. It's just so early. It's been so cold. I mean, never mind the windy patterns that we've seen around different stadiums, but it's been so cold. I would imagine there's probably an effect on walk rate. Walks are up this season. Pitchers probably are just having some trouble feeling their fingers and getting the spin that they want on their pitches. But mostly it is the fly ball distance. And so if you are a fly ball pitcher, then you are going to prefer to pitch when it's cold than when it is warm. Because when it's warm, then you're playing an old Chase Field in August.
Or we can go to the Dusty Baker description of it being your home country dictating how the proximity to the equator having an inverse proportional relationship for how you can deal with cold, simply because I never bought it. I never really understood it. But there are some in baseball who still believe that there are some of some extraction who have more difficulty dealing with it than others.
You could go with that, but Joey Votto's Canadian. He's had a slow start to the season, right? So that's one little data point. And have you seen these pictures that Fernando Rodney's posting of him playing in the snow?
Oh, it's amazing.
Sure he's not coming from a cold weather locale.
Oh, they're absolutely amazing. The Mets, speaking of cold weather locales, we saw Syndergaard throw in what was, I think, probably 30 degrees over the weekend. He was just absolutely filthy. I made fun when Barry Rosner was in for Dan a couple of weeks ago. I made fun of Barry for supporting the Mets as a potential playoff team. They're now 12-3, so joke's on me, I guess. Does it just come down to them having as many starters healthy as they can because of how it pushes their other good pitchers into the pen? Is it really that simple for them?
Yeah, they had a busy offseason, bring in some fringe players. I like Todd Frazier fine, but this season was really going to be determined by what they got out of Noah Syndergaard coming back, Michael Conforto coming back. With the Mets, I know it feels like it's too simple, but it really is just a question of health, because they have so much talent on the roster. They just need it to be able to play. And what's been most encouraging is Noah Syndergaard has shown no ill effects after missing most of last season. He's looked absolutely fantastic, and Michael Conforto is maybe been the best hitter on the team, coming off major shoulder surgery that, I mean, there was a point early on, I think it was overblown, but there was a point people were wondering, is he ever going to be the same for the rest of his career? And then they were thinking maybe he won't be back till June. Well, he came back in the middle of April and he's hitting the snot out of the ball. So Conforto looks great. Syndergaard looks great. I think every single time that we all watch Noah Syndergaard, we're kind of crossing our fingers, hoping that this won't be the pitch that does it, because no one else really throws like he does. You hope. I mean, he's got to be an injury risk almost every single time he takes the mound. But if the Mets are healthy and if they stay off the DL for the most part, they are a legitimate contender for that division, because as good as the Nationals are, the Mets at full strength are really, really strong. They're just so seldom at full strength.
Okay, so we brought this up yesterday, and you're the perfect guy to ask. It's about how you define a certain pitch. And there have been videos of Syndergaard's two-seamer going around that show this extreme pronation, really snapping the ball inside out. And it's not just a little tailing action. It's not just a little fade. It's a snap.
It's disgusting.
And when I was a kid, that was referred to as a screwball. And we've heard the term used before. I believe Hector Santiago said that when he really turns some of these pitches over, it's a screwball. I was saying late stage Greg Maddux, when he wasn't throwing as hard and the rotation had more of an effect because of the lower velocity, he had a sinker that he would throw that was categorized that way by some. What is a screwball? What was a screwball? Is there any value in pitch effects or in defining it that way, or is it just something we like saying?
I think we really like labels now with the pitch tracking information, and we can get precise measurements of speed, horizontal movement, vertical movement. And what I think we've come to learn is that there are labels, and then there is what the data is actually telling us. At least when I think of a screwball, I think of sort of a reverse curveball, right? So you'd have something that's thrown between, I don't know, 70 and 82 miles per hour, and you can get screwball action. But what is screwball action except a pitch that's breaking arm side, right? And it's going to be having some drop and a sinker. Especially a sinker thrown like Syndergaard's is a pitch that has a lot of arm side action, and it's going to drop. He's gripping it along the two seams. So when I look at it, it does, you could say it moves like a screwball, but then if it's moving, I don't know, 15, 20 miles per hour faster than a screwball, that doesn't really fit the screwball profile to me. I think of a screwball as a breaking pitch, and I think that this is just an extreme sinker. Pretty much any pitcher out there who's throwing a sinker, especially from a three quarters or a low three quarters arm side, is going to be getting a lot of arm side run, a fair amount of sink. You look at, gosh, any sidearm, look at what Adam Simber for the Padres, if you've seen him yet, he's coming from a low slot and he's getting a lot of run or tail on his pitches arm side. So a lot of things look like screwballs, but to me, I think it's the velocity difference. I can't fathom a screwball that's at 96 miles per hour, but I don't know. Maybe that's my own limitation.
Well, so this takes us directly to Bartolo Colon, and I can't believe we waited this long to talk about Bartolo with you, but let's talk about Bartolo. In your opinion, as Bartolo is approaching a perfect game against the Astros the other night, is he throwing two pitches, you know, the fastball and then something that's not a fastball, or is he really throwing eight? Because the velocity was relatively constant for all the fastballs, but they all did something different. It's amazing to watch.
Yeah, I think that we've been analyzing pitches. We got this pitch tracking technology first in, I think it was 2008, and ever since then, people like me have been just breaking down the pitches in the ways that we know, and we can say this guy throws a four seamer, he throws a sinker, a slider, changeup, whatever. You can look at all the different pitches the guy throws, but what I think we have done the least work on, what is underappreciated as a consequence, is how well pitchers can manipulate individual pitches that they do throw. I mean, you see Rich Hill, Lance McCullers, they're out there throwing three varieties of their curveball or something, they say. Patrick Corbin has two or three varieties of his slider. And a guy like Bartolo Colon, or you look at the Twins and Lance Lynn, these are guys who lean on a fastball very heavily. They're the most, I think, extreme fastball throwers among starting pitchers in baseball. But they're not throwing one fastball. They're probably throwing three or four or five. Maybe you could say it's one, and they just have this broad spectrum of movement and velocity they're able to put on the pitch. But it's something that it's hard to measure comparatively. It's hard to you can't just pull up a leaderboard and say Bartolo Colon's fastball has, I don't know, 50% more variety than Taiwan Walker's or something. But because of that, as a consequence, I think that there's just not a whole lot that's been written about it, and therefore it kind of gets lost in the mix, which is too bad, because this is clearly Colon's strength. He's kind of like a knuckleball pitcher, except he's throwing a fastball instead.
Jeff, always great. Look forward to talking again next week.
Thank you very much.
That is Jeff Sullivan, senior editor of FanGraphs. Tuesdays are baseball nerdy, because they always bring a Joe Madden at noon, too. Some non-baseball with Joe today also.
Yeah, he's made a few headlines. He's made it known what he'd like to have happen, I think, on a lot of different issues.
This segment brought to you by KFC. KFC is a new 100% white meat $5 fill-up. It comes with a breast and a whole wing. And that's how KFC came up with what to call this $5 fill-up.
We had a resurgence last night. We had a rebirth of sorts. Father Prime has struck, and it was a lot of fun to watch. Also, not only do we have that, there's beef. There's beef stewing in the NBA playoffs. And although one of these teams might be out and out quickly, I find this particular stew to be quite delicious.
He's Connor McKnight. I'm Dan Bernstein. We'll cook it up for you next on The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Thank him. We will.
Mm-hmm.
It's Dwayne Wade after putting it up against the Sixers. The Heat and Sixers have now drawn even. 28 points in 26 minutes from Dwayne Wade last night. I'm Connor McKnight. He's Dan Bernstein. This is the Bernstein and McKnight Show here on 670 The Score. Talking a lot of baseball in the first hour, hour and a half or so. And with the hoops last night, I got three little things that's going to take us all the way through last night's deck of games. Last night's two-pack, as it were. Dwayne Wade was fantastic. And as the Sixers tried to figure their stuff out, you had Ersan Ilyasova starting that game.
Now, before we begin.
Okay. There's a preface to Ersan Ilyasova?
Yes. People who have been listening to me for these many years know that I have an irrational hatred of Ersan Ilyasova's game.
Okay. Because in the first 9 minutes of the first quarter, so did I.
Okay. Now listen. And I almost tweeted this last night, but I was too busy involved with my bratwurst, which is another issue that has to be tackled here. Because I'm
quite a bratwurst there, Dan.
I'm having quite a day. I got some official acknowledgement of my bratwurst.
Brimming with bratwurst pride.
I'm very, very excited because what's going on social media. But I've never seen Ersan Ilyasova make a shot.
Okay.
Because if he has... And I'm sure my eyes have literally seen Ersan Ilyasova.
Your brain just won't let you process the trauma.
It won't record it. It flushes right through the system.
Sure.
He's always doing something that offends me. It might be the Vulcan look that he's got. He could be the nicest guy in the world and rescues baby kittens.
Probably.
I'm sure he is. But his game offends me.
So for the first 4.5-5 minutes of the game last night, he was forcing the issue, just trying to be – because everybody wrote about Ersan Ilyasova and how he was the matchup change that helped the Sixers really pull things apart against the Heat in game one and all that stuff. He's just forcing stuff at the rim, trying to get himself inside and not at all – there's four Sixers on the perimeter and Ilyasova just trying to move himself underneath. I'm thinking that can't be what they're trying to get done here. And then the second half of the first quarter, he puts up, you know, like 10 points and, everything goes fine for the Sixers. And then suddenly Dwayne Wade's in the ballgame. And it was kind of I don't know how it felt for you. I don't know how it felt for those who were watching Wade and the Heat last night, but it was almost a slow burn for me. The first couple of possessions, you know, he heads down to the corner and hits that signature fadeaway, I think, for 6 out of 6.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, okay, that's 6 out of 6. And now the Heat have like this 8-9 point lead, whatever it was, and this kind of feels like Dwayne Wade takeover territory. And I had to check the calendar. I was thinking this is he's playing for the Heat again. He's wearing 3. It's still 2018.
Who did he look like though? Because the answer is not Dwayne Wade.
Well, we were just talking about the fadeaway yesterday with I think in transition with Molly and Hanley.
There were
talking
two
about,
moves.
Okay, it's that Jordan type fadeaway.
It's Wizards Jordan.
Yeah.
He was he was literally doing Wizards Jordan stuff. Jordan had 2 shots when he returned to the Wizards. He had what was left of the fadeaway, and he had
which was a lot.
And he had a really good pump fake that he got people in the air and got fouled and got and ones because he was still physically really strong. But old broke Wizards Jordan had a little fadeaway. And he had the pump fake, and Dwayne Wade had old Jordan on display last night.
It was really pretty impressive. And I, you know, all throughout Twitter when it was working last night were thoughts of the Heat from a perspective that I didn't necessarily see coming. I mean, I think a lot of people thought Eric Spoelstra and his coaching ability could get Ben Simmons to cool down, right?
Okay.
I think a lot of people thought that they were going to be able to limit that Sixers offense and really give them a hard time. I don't think anyone saw this from a perspective of, what if Dwayne Wade steals you a game? Nobody was going into this thing going, well, what if Dwayne Wade has a night and brings you one.
Yeah, we didn't have that sort of in the scenarios
that
list,
wasn't
right?
In the calculus. That wasn't part of the math.
Although Chris Mannix, when we had him on, and I mentioned how underrated Eric Spoelstra has been and how underappreciated Eric Spoelstra has
absolutely
been,
did.
He said, I think the Heat are going to win that series. And look, the Heat don't have a guy, but maybe they don't have to have a guy. Because everybody's good. They don't really have a limiting factor. They don't cover for people. They've got guys you've never heard of. They bust their ass. They play hard.
I'll live with Hassan Whiteside not showing up.
And now you get more Whiteside if Embiid's back.
Correct.
Yeah. And Embiid has just roasted him all
which
year.
Which is going to be a problem.
Now, you said you had more to unpack.
I'm going
to
get us all the way through the NBA slate last night.
Okay. Once you're done with that, I have an NBA note about a surging NBA player who people have noticed, but it is a great job by Greg Doyle, our old friend, pointing out exactly what he did, what Nate McMillan saw. And I love pieces like this because they explain not just, oh, he was good and then he wasn't so good and now he's good again. He found out why. He found it's something very, very simple that happened.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to the Bernstein and McKnight Show, talking a little hoop. And with Dwayne Wade going off for 28 in 26 minutes, it kind of gets us to something that Rick Camp just pointed out before the update. We are, it seems, at some point in this series, going to see Joel Embiid back on the court for the Sixers. And that will, it seems, mean more Hassan Whiteside, which is more so a problem for the Heat than it is a problem for Joel Embiid, assuming he's healthy. You follow Joel on Instagram, right? You follow him in all forms of social
Instagram.
Media? He's entertaining. He is an entertaining social media follow, but he Instagram in his story on Instagram, I think it's a story on Instagram, whatever it is, Instagram Now or something like that. He threw up there, I'm sick and tired, and Joe's been having in the updates here, sick and tired of being babied. Now, there was some questionable language in there as well that we can't get around here because of the FCC, but still, he's putting it out there that he wants to play, that he is ready, in his estimation, to play.
So he's the opposite of Kawhi Leonard.
Well, and that's our third point in this triangle here. Do you hear Greg Popovich after the game?
Okay.
Do you hear some of this post-game stuff?
I think that you, the Bernstein and McKnight listener, should judge this for yourself. And our question, let's play the game show, is this shade?
LaMarcus has been a monster all year long. Led our team at both ends of the floor. He doesn't complain about a darn thing out on the court. He just plays through everything. I can't imagine being more proud of a player as far as playing through adversity and being there for his teammates night after night after night. He's been fantastic.
Huh. Hmm.
Yes.
Leaning toward yes.
For me, that is a yes.
That's about as much shade as Popovich will throw at his own player. The president, something different. Player, yeah, that's about as much as you'll get. I've been fascinated because of the dynamic that Popovich and the Spurs have created my entire life. I mean, before him, the Spurs weren't at all relevant to me in watching hoops. Not even a little bit.
You didn't have the George Gervin era.
No, right. No. Read about it, didn't see it, didn't watch it. But for this to be, for the culture to have been something that was so revered over quite literally the last two decades, for the dynamic of players that have come in and out of that system, you know, the drafting foreign dudes and letting them mature a little bit like Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili, you lose David Robertson, you get Tim Duncan, you find that style of play, and you're able to, for years, you kept Tim Duncan, you kept guys around, you made things work, and you brought in players, Bruce Bowen and the whole, to get a situation like this that is so modern NBA, for all of the right and seemingly wrong reasons. It's fascinating to me to see some of this, because we've seen Popovich on the court go from old school to new school. He had the two bigs. He used that system. He played the mid-90s, late-90s NBA-style ball. He pioneered some of that stuff. And now we've seen him over the last few years shift completely away. We've seen LaMarcus Aldridge, a guy whose game wouldn't... When he signed, check me if I'm wrong, but when he signed with the Spurs, that was a little bit of a... Anathema is probably going a little bit too far, but to say that really jived with his system was people were wondering exactly how that was going to work.
And he, of course, shrugged it off and said he didn't really have a system. I don't know what people are saying about it. He's like, we'll do whatever we have to do with whoever we got.
Well, that's kind of a system, isn't it? I mean, maximizing the usage of your players and figuring out who needs to play. Yeah, that's kind of a system.
Well, I also think that, to me, the significance of the Kawhi Leonard story, and just in a nutshell, the team believes that he's healthy enough to play. And it's an ankle injury, correct?
Quad.
Oh, this is the quad, right?
It's the muscle quad.
The quad tendon.
Quad tendon.
The reason
I jumped to ankle was because somebody gave a Grant Hill comp in there, and somebody said that he's not coming back because he's afraid of being the next Grant Hill, afraid of coming back too early and pushing himself and being a Hall of Fame level player despite not achieving what many would think he could because of injuries. And teammates are wondering why he's been out of touch. He's surrounded himself with what Popovich has called his group.
He's not there.
And he may be preserving, believes he got a Supermax contract coming from somebody, and there are some who believe he is simply preserving himself rather than giving his team the best chance to win.
If he's healthy, when he's healthy, he's a top 10 type guy in the league.
Yeah, he's a second tier all NBA player. I guess it's another way of saying that. He's in the 5 to 10.
Yes, he is absolutely there. And I don't have many doubts that if healthy, he would get the Supermax treatment, that kind
if
of
If Zach Levine
contract.
Is talking about it, then I certainly think Kawhi Leonard should.
You don't think the Spurs are still going to offer him the DPE, the designated player exception?
Well, unless they trade him.
Right. Well, that's the part of the next question is if you know that life can't go on with Kawhi Leonard, If they've made the decision already that life can't, that there is no reconciling, that there's no conversation Popovich is going to have with Tim Duncan before he goes to, where was it, the Orlando Magic that he was really close to signing with back in the day? Yeah. If there's no come to Jesus at the end of the season, if there's no, then you have to move on.
And then John Paxson better be on the phone, right?
That opens up, I think, this league, this free agent. I know LeBron is going to be a free agent, and I am fascinated to see exactly how that works out and the conversation around it. I'm still kind of convinced myself that he heads back to Cleveland and just gets more power there, but that's beside the point, especially if Kawhi Leonard becomes this other entity that exists out there for teams that either want to win now or want to try and build around.
We've been watching a rising star in the NBA who's still alive in the playoffs, and he did something in his game that I found really cool. And it's analysis of basketball. It's purely scouting. It is not statistical. There is no gory math involved. It's simply explaining how a player responded to defensive attention in a way that obviated that defensive attention. A coach simply, again, noticing things. A coach just noticed something and said, hey, why not try this? And he said, okay. And it has worked, and nobody has figured out a way to stop it.
Nice.
So we will get to that. And top of the hour, we will hit the midday midway on the Bernstein and McKnight Show on The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
That's the guy, Victor Oladipo. He's done something very interesting. This segment brought to you by Credit Karma. Get your truly free credit score and free credit monitoring from Credit Karma. Download the Credit Karma app today. Credit Karma, get knowing. Bernstein and McKnight, your new Score midday show from 9 to 1, Monday through Friday.
So you're saying Vic did something more interesting than 32 in 37 minutes with a plus. Where do you come down to the plus minus thing for NBA games?
Well, there's effective plus minus. I'm just talking
about straight up plus minus. I like it as an indicator of like, hey, look at this, and then maybe there's more to go find out, but I'm not married to it any one way or another. He's plus 21 though against the Cavs. Just about everybody though in game one was
right
plus double digits. That was a beatdown.
Yeah, I think it's an okay stat. It's not one that I usually go to quickly.
An indicator stat.
So this year Victor Oladipo came out hot. He was playing great. And then he wasn't playing so great, and he was struggling a little bit, and more obtuse observers said things like, oh, he's hitting the wall. What the hell does that mean?
There's an actual wall in practice that the Pacers use.
No, there's but see, this is what bothers me about lazy sports narratives. Sometimes you can find out why. Sometimes then when somebody plays better and they say, well, he just got through that period where he wasn't any good, ask coaches. Ask players, ask around, watch film, sit with people who know how to watch film, and maybe we advance beyond just, oh, he's hit a wall, or dead arm period, or any of these things that we say, and we can literally find out what's happening. So how about this? Our guy Greg Doyle in the Indianapolis Star was watching Victor Oladipo in practice and watching him working on a move, and it led to some conversations, and then it led to figuring out, well, wait a second, when did he start doing this? And as it turned out, Victor Oladipo started the year not getting all that much defensive attention because he was Victor Oladipo.
Okay.
And he's been working on his game, and he's a really good player. And you know, I loved him coming out of college. I'm finally right about him.
You were a big Oladipo guy.
I was, and I believe my comment on Oladipo pre-draft was, I don't know exactly. I said he violated my rule, where my rule in NBA scouting is I have to know what you do for me. I said, what is your one thing that I know I put you out there? What am I going to get from you? What do you do for me? And I said, he violates that, but I want him on my team. So despite my better sense, and even with those misgivings, I just loved him.
Thoroughly enjoyed him at Indiana. Oh. Really liked him. They let him put the ball on the floor, which was fun to watch.
And what happened was, as the year started, eventually word gets around that, hey, we have to take away Oladipo on this remodeled Nate McMillan-coached Pacers team that nobody thought would be any good. Nobody knew how good Donatas Sabonis was or what Miles Turner was going to be. But as the year wore on and we realized, oh, he's an all-star now, what happened was they decided to throw a lot of defenders at him. And as he writes, it changed. Teams were no longer defending him straight up or even with one man and four other sets of eyeballs watching him ready to help. No, teams were now throwing multiple defenders at Oladipo, getting physical with him, bullying him. As Tyronn Lue put it, show him a crowd. Because he was talking about how to defend Oladipo. He slumped. The numbers are clear. In 52 games before the All-Star break, he was at 24.4 points per game, shot 48.4%, and 38% on threes. Career bests. In the 15 games after the All-Star break, scoring down to 19.2, shooting down to 41.1 overall, and 29.7 on threes. The only number that went up, turnovers.
It's not the number you want to go up.
Nate McMillan did some thinking. This was his responsibility. He was the one who had set Oladipo free back in October, summoning him to meeting after meeting during training camp, telling Oladipo he was a better player than his numbers in Orlando and Oklahoma City suggested. But his first four pro seasons, he'd averaged only 15.9 points. The numbers said he was very good. No, McMillan told him, you're better than that, and we need more. And Oladipo said, words can't really describe that. My entire career, nobody's done that. And you saw what happened. Five games into the season, averaging 26 points. The sixth game against San Antonio, the game he won at the buzzer, pointed to the floor, his city. But after the All-Star break, and he was slumping. But Nate McMillan saw something happening. Opposing teams were showing, indeed, Oladipo a crowd. He summoned Oladipo to another meeting. Here, McMillan said, try this. He said, Oladipo has all sorts of high-level basketball skill and ability, but he has one athletic trait that few in the athletic freak show of the NBA can match. Speed. Lots of guys are fast, but his speed is at another level, a level that surprised even McMillan in the preseason. He said, Oladipo is fast. So he said, try this. Get the ball and back up.
Really?
Back up before the double team can come. How far back? As far as you want. Beyond shooting range. Keep backing up. Size up the defense, and then you charge. You make the defender choose. So McMillan was telling Oladipo, move your feet and beat the guy to the spot. Or wave the white flag, backpedal as you approach, and then you can dribble into an open three-pointer. Said Oladipo's response, his signature smile. So what he told him was, if teams are taking away your open court speed, your open court advantage, make more open court.
That's awesome. So it lets you define the encounter as opposed to the defense defining the encounter.
Because at some point, a double teamer is going to be looking at the sidelines saying, should
I am so far away right now.
It's like John Lester in the leadoffs, right? It's just something where something overrides.
Can't trust it.
Something overrides what you are coached to be like. Should I be doubling here? Because now I can't get back to my guy. That's another thing that that does.
Right.
Is it spreads out the double teaming distance. We're sort of like a guy getting a leadoff. He's concerned about how far, how quickly he can get back to his initial responsibility. It's brilliant.
Okay, so that does do, if Oladipo is going to back that far away, we'll look for this as the Pacers go on, is if he's going to back that far away, it makes his, if he chooses to pass, it does that make that initial pass a little less effective, right? Because
of
the distance it has to
greater
cover.
Greater variance, and that pass has less of a margin for error. Sure.
So you start to look for, if Oladipo's going to back it out like that, his choices dwindle a little bit, right? He has to attack. Granted, him on the attack is probably the best option for the Pacers setting up an offense. He can dish. He can take it to the rack. He can pull it back out again, all that kind of stuff. But that's a really interesting attack to something that we've seen quite a bit. I mean, you've got such good shooters in the league. The double teams, that you're seeing screens now that are set in places you didn't see them just a few years ago.
And I think there's over-screening when it comes to really fast players. Some guys don't need a ball screen. And all you're doing is bringing another defender there unnecessarily. I understand the principles of screen roll and the spacing of screen roll. But a guy like Oladipo, he doesn't need a screen. All he needs is a step. And I'm reminded of vintage Allen Iverson. And it's one of the things I loved covering some of those Iverson Sixers teams, was going in and looking at the Bulls board and looking at how the Bulls had diagrammed the Sixers plays. And how many of their plays were simply opportunities for the same thing, for Iverson to get a step on somebody, because that may be the fastest. He and Jason Kidd, end-to-end, might be the two fastest players I've seen. I mean, Oladipo's fast, but Iverson was preternaturally fast. That was ridiculous. And they did something where if you don't mind getting a basketball wonky here, that a floppy action or a single-double set would be a double screen on one side of the key and a single screen on the old school point guard offense set.
All right.
And some teams would stagger it, where you make the screen a little bit wider rather than a shoulder-to-shoulder double screen. They're offset. So create a larger area in the double screen to stagger it for the cutter. What the Sixers did was flatten everything out almost completely to what they called a baseline chase. And what this allowed Iverson to do, picture strong point guard dribbling on one wing. On the opposite wing is Iverson. Iverson then, as the play begins, Iverson runs full speed, almost instead of a V-shaped cut, they turn it into a U-shaped, where he runs all the way around that double screen and all the way down the baseline and all the way around the wide set single screen, just waiting for that little curl to get the ball. So they're betting no one defender could possibly stay with him that long, because he's just too fast. So one of the screeners' men is going to have to at some point jump out.
Right.
And then if you get in the ball, it's lights out mismatch.
Huh.
So they took a basic single-double and did a baseline chase action, not because he was the greatest shooter, but just because nobody could run with him through all those screens.
So as you talk about that kind of action and how Oladipo has worked to kind of counter off the bodies that he's been thrown at him, my next question is this. Do the Cavs solve this just by throwing LeBron at him more often?
And his name just came up on the text line, too. This is great. The 309 says LeBron James does that same backup move when he sees the double team coming, too. And it seems like he scores every time he does it. That's, see, a little different in the case of LeBron.
Slightly.
Because when he's buying space and time, he may not be looking for his own offensive opportunity.
Oh, of course not.
All he's doing is recalculating the best shot.
3-4 moves down the line is what he's able to do. I just wonder defensively, with a team that's been as bad this season defensively as the Cavaliers have, regardless of how their lineups have looked, regardless of what trades they ended up making at the deadline, I don't know what would then happen if you just stick LeBron on Oladipo, if that's the issue. We saw it happen years ago as he manned up on Derrick Rose, and how that changed the course of an entire, well, flattened out the series pretty quickly, I guess. But I don't know what the counter off of that is.
That's just cool, though, isn't it?
It is fantastic.
It's just for a coach to say, hey, yeah, of course you're in a crowd. Get out of the crowd. Back up. It's okay. You can find yourself some space and make them nervous. And another texter says, effectively, he's turned the Red October towards the torpedo before it can arm itself. I love it.
A lot of things in here don't react well to bullets.
It's wise to know what is this, the ways of one's opponent. Yes, it is.
It's got some Scottish accent in the bowels of a Russian submarine.
We always wanted to know why the Lithuanian captain from Vilnius sounds like a Scotsman. We will never know, but it always made me nervous.
Underrated in that movie, Sam Neill. Fantastic.
I would like to have seen Montana.
Gets me every time. It gets me every time.
Next up, the midday midway. The NFL is so evil. They're so smart. You talk about just the villainous evil. They're doing it again with a little PR move here that you just, I would applaud them if I didn't resent them so much.
Baseball's done their thing again. They get so out in front of they want to bring in the young viewer, mm-hmm. and then they find the thing that the young viewer likes and they kill it.
They kill the young viewer.
Any damn
they kill the
sense.
Thing.
It was a dangling modifier. My apologies. They kill the young viewer.
All right, put your modifier back. We will hit the midway next on the score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.